Clinton's economic program, at first announced as a job creation program, was soon to change direction and concentrate on reduction of the deficit, which under Reagan and Bush had left a national debt of $4 trillion. But this emphasis meant that there would be no bold program of expenditures for universal health care, education, child care, housing, the environment, the arts, or job creation. Clinton's small gestures would not come close to what was needed in a nation where one-fourth of the children lived in poverty, where homeless people lived on the streets in every major city, where women could not look for work for lack of child care, where the air, the water, were deteriorating dangerously. The United States was the richest country in the world, with 5% of the Earth's population, yet consuming 30% of what was produced worldwide. But only a tiny portion of the American population benefited. This richest 1% of the population saw its wealth increase enormously starting in the late 1970s. As a result of changes in the tax structure, by 1995, that richest 1% had gained over $1 trillion and now owned over 40% of the nation's wealth. According to the business magazine Forbes, the 400 richest families owned $92 billion in 1982, but 13 years later, this had jumped to $480 billion. In the 90s, the wealth of the 500 corporations of the Standard & Poor's Index had increased by 335%. The Dow Jones average of stock prices had gone up 400% between 1980 and 1995, while the average wage of workers had declined in purchasing power by 15%. It was therefore possible to say that the U.S. economy was healthy, but only if you considered the richest part of the population. Meanwhile, 40 million people were without health insurance, the number having risen by 33% in the 90s. And infants died of sickness and malnutrition at a rate higher than that of any other industrialized country. There seemed to be unlimited funds for the military, but people who performed vital human services in health and education had to struggle to barely survive. A 27-year-old woman named Kim Lee Jacobson, interviewed in the Boston Globe, epitomized the distorted national priorities. She had been named U.S. Toddler Teacher of 1999. But, as she said, "I'm hitting $20,000 this year after 5 years in the field. It all works out. I didn't come for a lot of money, so I don't expect to have a lot." According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the U.S. Census Bureau, in 1998, one of every three working people in the United States had jobs paying at or below the federal poverty level. The writer Barbara Ehrenreich spent a year working at various jobs, house cleaner, waitress, factory worker, and reported in her book Nickeled and Dimed, the jobs such as those left workers unable to afford housing or medical care or even adequate food. For people of color, the statistics were especially troubling. Black infants died at twice the rate of white children, and the life expectancy of a black man in Harlem, according to a United Nations report, was 46 years, less than that in Cambodia or the Sudan. This racial discrepancy was explained by some people as racial inferiority, as genetic deficiency, but what was clear was that growing up in a terrible environment, whatever one's natural abilities, became an insurmountable handicap for millions of Americans, whether white or black. A Carnegie Endowment study showed that two young people of equal standing on intelligence tests, even accepting the dubious worth of intelligence tests for children brought up under different circumstances, had very different futures depending on whom their parents were. The child of a lawyer, though rating no higher on mental tests than the child of a janitor, was 4 times as likely to go to college, 12 times as likely to finish college, and 27 times as likely to end up in the top 10% of American incomes. To change that situation, to bring about even a rough equality of opportunity, would require a drastic redistribution of wealth, a huge expenditure of money for job creation, health, education, and the environment. The United States, instead, was consigning its people to the mercy of the free market, forgetting or choosing to forget the disastrous consequence of such a policy in the 1920s. The market did not care about the environment or the arts, and it left many Americans without the basic means of subsistence, including adequate housing. Under Reagan, the government had reduced the number of housing units getting subsidies from 400,000 to 40,000. In the Clinton administration, the program ended altogether. Despite Clinton's 1997 Inauguration Day promise of new government, his presidency offered no bold program to take care of these needs. For instance, although public opinion polls through the 80s and 90s indicated that the American people would support a program of free, universal medical care supported by the General Treasury, Clinton was reluctant to advocate this. Instead, he put his wife Hillary in charge of a commission whose final report was over 1,000 pages long, impossibly dense and complicated, and yet offering no answer to the problem: how to assure every American medical care free of the intervention of profiteering insurance companies. Aside from creating an even larger deficit, and there were economists who did not believe that reducing the deficit was necessary when crucial needs were not being met, there were two possible sources to pay for a bold program of social reconstruction, and the Clinton administration was not inclined to tap either one. One source was the military budget. Randall Forsberg, an expert on military expenditures, had suggested during the presidential campaign of 1992 that a military budget of $60 billion to be achieved over a number of years would support a demilitarized U.S. foreign policy appropriate to the needs and opportunities of the post-Cold War world. However, the military budget kept increasing, even after the fall of the supposed target of the military buildup, and by the end of Clinton's term, the military budget was about $300 billion a year. A radical reduction of the military budget would require a renunciation of war, a withdrawal of military bases from around the world, an acceptance, finally, of the principle enunciated in the United Nations Charter that the world should renounce the scourge of war. It would speak to the fundamental human desire, overwhelmed too often by barrages of super patriotic slogans, to live at peace with others. The public appeal for such a dramatic policy change would be based on a simple but powerful moral argument: that given the nature of modern warfare, the victims would be mostly civilians. To put it another way, war in our time is always a war against children. And if the children of other countries are to be granted an equal right to life with our own children, then we must use our extraordinary human ingenuity to find non-military solutions for world problems. The other possible source to pay for social reform was the wealth of the super rich. The richest 1% of the country had gained over $1 trillion in the 80s and 90s as a result of tax breaks. A wealth tax, something not yet done as national policy, but perfectly feasible, could retrieve that $1 trillion. For instance, at $100 billion a year for 10 years, and still leave that 1% very, very rich. In addition, a truly progressive income tax, going back to the post-World War II levels of 70 to 90% on very high incomes, could yield another $100 billion a year. Clinton did raise taxes on the super rich by a few percentage points, changing the top rate from 31% to 37%, and corporate taxes from 34% to 35%, but this was a pitifully small step in view of the need. With the $400 or $500 billion that might be gained each year by progressive taxation and demilitarization, there would be funds available to pay for a universal health care system funded by the government as Medicare is administered, as the health care system in Canada is handled, without the profit taking by insurance companies. Those funds could pay for a full employment program, for the first time implementing the 1946 Full Employment Act, which committed the national government to creating useful employment opportunities for all people able and willing to work. One of Marge Piercy's poems ends with the lines, "The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real." Instead of giving out contracts for jet bombers and nuclear submarines, contracts could be offered to nonprofit corporations to hire people to build homes, construct public transport systems, clean up the rivers and lakes, turn our cities into decent places to live. The alternative to such a bold program was to continue as before, allowing the cities to fester, forcing rural people to face debt and foreclosures, offering no useful work for the young, creating a marginal population of idle, desperate people, many of them young, many of them people of color, who turn to drugs and crime, constituting a threat to the physical security of the rest of the population.